Good evening and welcome to Green Street, the Tuesday evening environmental health program here on WBAI, where we don't talk about politics per se, but we do talk about things in the environment that can affect your health and how you and your family can live a healthy and happy life in this increasingly toxic world. And sometimes that does get a little political, and it probably will tonight again. I'm your co-host, Doug Wood, joined tonight, as I am every night, by my co-host, Patty Wood.
Good evening.
Patty. We're a team here on WBAI.
And, yes, we are.
And in everything else we do. Tonight we're going to be talking about your government at work and how the FDA has decided to approve the use of a toxic chemical pesticide for use on the food that we eat. Sounds incredible, I know, but it's true. So stay tuned for that. We're going to have a guest, a very knowledgeable guest, who will tell us more about that. We are going to move on. I think we're about to get our guest on the air, and I wanted to first talk about the do you want to take care of this, talk about this press release we saw the other day? Got our attention?
There's a press release that got our attention and actually inspired us to invite our guest this evening. And that's the Dow AgroSciences announcing that their company has been notified by the United States Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, that the agency has found both endless corn and endless soybeans to be in compliance with the legal and regulatory requirements that fall within the FDA's jurisdiction. The endless weed control system is an innovative combination of herbicides and herbicide-tolerant traits in elite corn and soybean germplasm, and is designed to meet the emerging weed control challenges facing farmers while sustaining beneficial farming practices, and will be introduced once all regulatory approvals are secured. We are certain that in Washington that these regulatory approvals will be secured, as they have been many times before. So we're going to talk about this with a guest that has been on our show before. This is Jay Feldman. He is the executive director of Beyond Pesticides, a nonprofit organization that works with other organizations across the country to protect public health and the environment and to lead the transition to a world free of toxic pesticides. Over 30 years, his work with media has helped to bring broader public understanding of the hazards of pesticides. Jay has a master's degree in urban and regional planning and a BA in political science, and we are happy to welcome him back to Green Street. Hello, Jay.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're good.
Doing great. So glad you can join us here.
Yeah. So, wow, this is, we might be changing the signs, right? The signs from Roundup Ready to 2,4-D Ready?
Yep.
Is that where we're going?
Yeah, it seems like we're headed down that road. You know, it's interesting. You talked about a regulatory system and FDA approval. The government, the U.S. government, has something called the Coordinated Framework for the Regulation of Biotechnology, which is really an uncoordinated framework. And it involves three agencies, USDA, which has oversight over the actual plants.
Mm-hmm.
The genetically engineered plants, EPA,
right,
which is supposed to look at the pesticides, in this case 2,4-D, previously glyphosate or Roundup Ready.
Right.
And FDA, which has jurisdiction over the food.
Food, right.
But principally from a labeling standpoint, and FDA determined years ago that, you know, there was no real need or requirement under the law to label food as being genetically engineered. Even though countries all around the world, the European Union and most developed countries, actually require this type of labeling. The interesting thing about this lack of coordination is that since the introduction of biotechnology into the food supply and the adoption of this framework in 86, we have as a nation not passed any laws to address any of the novel harms or risks that genetic engineering creates. And that's an astounding statement or fact in light of the fact that, as you know, these are patented materials, and they are expressly patented because they have novel characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an implicit contradiction there where our government is basically disassociating itself from any regulatory responsibility associated with any unique characteristics associated with these plants, these engineered plants, and the associated chemical use, even though, on the other hand, the patent office is giving these plants patent protection.
That's a great point. So on the one hand, they're saying we're so unusual, we deserve a patent, and here's the FDA saying, no, there's no difference between your corn and everybody else's corn.
Exactly.
Right.
That's just and, you know, the other element we're struggling with here is that because these things are patented, you don't see any independent research really happening. Mm. I mean, you know, you have to get permission from the owner of the patent to use the material.
So to do the research.
So typical university research that goes on, even though we know a lot of the research that goes on land-grant institutions are controlled by chemical companies or the agrochemical industry, this makes that situation even worse, because should you be able to generate independent funds to do research, you can't study the patented material without the agreement. This is worse than
we thought. Okay, let's take a few steps back and let's talk to our audience a little bit about Roundup and what has happened here, because you know, I think a typical consumer would use Roundup, you know, on their own property,
right,
for weeds, you know, on their driveways. We've all seen the ads, you know, where, you know, we've got two suburbanites and, you know, one uses Roundup and he doesn't have any weeds in the cracks in his driveways and, you know, and his neighbor does. And okay. So, and it's a very, very commonly, used product for the homeowner. But at the same time, it has been being used extensively in agriculture. And so what has happened? Why aren't we continuing to use Roundup?
Well, it's a very interesting story. I mean, you know, it was originally sold as part of this bioengineered plant as a way of reducing pesticide dependency. And so back in 2000, we used about 4.4 million pounds of glyphosate after the introduction of these crops. And, you know, as you know, and maybe the audience knows, or we should know, that this type of technology has taken over much of our food supply. I mean, we're looking at 86% of corn now genetically engineered, 93% of soy, 90% of canola oil. I mean, these are huge numbers, 93% of cotton, 95% of sugar beets. So this is not a new phenomenon, but it was promised. You know, the promise of this technology was that it would reduce environmental impacts associated with pesticide use. And in fact, we've seen the use of glyphosate rise from 4.4 million in 2000 to over 57 million pounds in 2010. Obviously, the claim that we were reducing reliance has not played out. And in fact, we're seeing, as a result of that, I would say, I mean, although the causes are not perfectly understood yet, but certainly what we're seeing in addition to this is resistance, which is what I think you're getting at, and that
right.
is that the chemicals, whenever you see this high dependency and you see agronomic practices which are antithetical to ecological protection, where you encourage natural predators and ecological balance, and you try to respect the power of nature, you know, in the crop production system or in any growing system, be it a garden or an agricultural field, with this technological promise, you know, farmers were told, well, you didn't have to worry about tillage and you didn't have to worry about rotations. You know, this was the 21st century and, you know, we could engineer this plant to do exactly what you wanted to do. Well, lo and behold, resistance is severe. You can tell it's severe because in October, EPA put out an announcement and request to generate information on resistance. Resistance, I think, both to this type of phenomenon, which we're discussing, which is an herbicide-resistant plant, as well as resistance, which is showing up throughout the Midwest now, to these, they're called pesticide incorporated protectants, where they put an insecticide, like a natural bacterium, soil bacterium, in this case BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, into the plant. And that, too, is showing resistance. And so, you know, I always say, you know, when EPA acknowleges a problem, then, you know.
And it's a big problem.
We've got an iceberg under that awareness.
Yeah, it's a big problem.
So, you know, that was back in October, and the comment period goes through January. But this is playing with nature.
Nature
always wins.
What we're saying in the case of this Roundup Ready corn is we've got a whole new generation of super weeds that are resistant to the Roundup.
Yes.
I mean, nature is smart. Nature knows how to find workarounds.
The other thing that, you know, is new, and again, it's hard to study this stuff, but there's a professor out of Purdue, an emeritus, Don Huber, who is studying this, and what he and some of his colleagues are finding is that these chemicals are, and the chemicals meaning, you know, the resistance capacity in addition to the application of the chemical. So it's the engineered plant in addition to the use of glyphosate is affecting soil nutrients. And what you're doing essentially with the glyphosate is you're blocking the ability of the plant to absorb the nutrients from the soil. But in the context of doing that, he is finding that we're producing super pathogens. So in effect, what we're doing is we're creating an environment that allows a pathogen that has not to this point in time been a problem. I mean, the same thing we see with resistance, you know. You see secondary resistance and secondary pest resistance, where you're killing off natural predators and creating a new pest that we had lived with fine in a natural ecosystem.
Right, because there was a balance, right?
But once we affected that balance, we create a secondary problem. And it seems as though this is happening with these systems of Roundup Ready, and that super pathogen, their concern is being fed to farm animals, and they're seeing effects in the animals as well. So, you know, it's a chain reaction of effects. And again, it goes back to the fact that we don't really test for these unique properties and these unique events that we're creating. It's really interesting. There's a law that fits into this uncoordinated framework that I mentioned earlier, and it's a law that you really don't hear much about. It's called the Plant Protection Act. In fact, I heard an environmental attorney speak, and he said even the best environmental law schools do not study this statute. And what this statute does is it really gives the USDA the authority to find that a plant is not a pest. So in other words, if you go to, as Monsanto, you go to USDA and you say, I've got this, you know, Roundup Ready plant, USDA is going to look at it and say, well, if we allow you to introduce this plant, are you going to create a pest? And USDA has found that, in fact, no, they are not going to create a pest problem, and therefore they can deregulate it or commercialize it. They call it deregulation. This is what they did about a year ago with alfalfa. Alfalfa is an interesting story because alfalfa Roundup Ready is a crop that is one of the crops in our country, even in a conventional system, that is least dependent on any pest control. It's one of those crops that is naturally resistant to disease.
Hardy doesn't need a whole lot of attention.
And yet, again, you know, Monsanto sees a market opportunity. This is not good for farmers. It's not good for consumers. It's another market opportunity. And instead of evaluating the essentiality of this, the need for this, the complexities around it, the lack of information, USDA, all it had to do was find that it was not a plant pest. Now, because of groups like the Center for Food Safety, and ongoing litigation, they're trying, you know, in coordination with a lot of seed producers, conventional and organic, and environmental organizations, to try to say that USDA has more responsibility than that. It has to look at the impacts under the the National Environmental Policy Act, the NEPA, and do an environmental impact statement and do that in a very detailed and, you know, meaningful way, which the department hasn't done heretofore.
You're listening to Green Street on WBAI, and we're talking with Jay Feldman, the executive director of Beyond Pesticides. Jay, your website is www.beyondpesticides.org, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And which I've also, I put the link up on our show page
right.
if anybody's interested. So I want to move along and talk about 2,4-D because 2,4-D is one of the things that, you know, we've talked about for years. And when I saw this press release, because, you know, we know kind of how toxic 2,4-D is, but why don't you talk a little bit about 2,4-D? And I was curious to know what you thought when you saw the press release.
Well, you know, this whole thing seems ludicrous, crazy.
Based on what you were just talking about, it seems as though somebody would say, "Why would we do this again? We've got all these problems."
Well, so. We have to use something that's a little bit different, that probably affects the plants a little bit differently, and may actually be in some cases more potent as an herbicide.
Anyway, yeah. I interrupted.
Well,
you,
we
I'm
all
sorry.
Know. I mean, 2,4-D, as you know, it was the half of the mixture of Agent Orange. So it was 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. And the list of impacts, adverse effects in the scientific literature is quite astounding, from cancer to birth defects, reproductive toxicity, you know, and kidney liver damage and neurotoxicity. All the sort of flashpoints are met when you look at 2,4-D. And the epidemiology on 2,4-D as well is quite astounding. The impacts on farmers and elevated rates of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and other types of cancers is well documented. Households that use 2,4-D see elevated rates of cancer in children, and canine lymphoma is elevated in households that use 2,4-D. So, you know, it's not just laboratory studies. It's studies that look at real-world exposure and
epidemiological studies.
Right.
There's a
right.
lot on this, yeah.
A lot. So, and of course, we have all the studies coming out of Vietnam where it was widely used as a defoliant. Now, you know, it was used admittedly as a mixture, certainly either Agent Orange with 2,4-5-T or Agent White with Picloram, but nevertheless, it was a major ingredient. And so you've got to look at those studies and in conjunction with other studies that we're seeing of independent use of 2,4-D. The other thing, of course, that we're very concerned about 2,4-D is endocrine disruption.
Mm-hmm.
This hasn't been adequately studied by EPA, even though it's an endpoint that obviously the world community is very concerned about. EPA and Congress are concerned about it, but we just haven't gotten the protocol together yet to actually make the official findings, even though we know from studies around the world and the European Union that there are dozens of endocrine disruptors and 2,4-D is among them. So
Jay, just let me just stop you for a minute. I hate to interrupt because what you're saying is so fascinating, but let's just talk about the Weed Science Society meeting that introduced this new 2,4-D product that is ostensibly going to be used as a replacement for Roundup or glyphosate on what you told us before, corn, soy, cotton, sugar beets, and so on. And they say in their press release about this new product that toxicology studies have shown that 2,4-D is not a reproductive toxicant, not a developmental neurotoxin, nor a developmental immunotoxin. There's no evidence of carcinogenicity or endocrine disruption. In mammals, 2,4-D is not metabolized. It is rapidly excreted, does not accumulate. Sound science and years of reviews by international regulatory organizations, blah, 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 have confirmed all of these observations.
Yeah.
How do they get away with that?
It's exactly the opposite of what you have just told. How do they get away with that?
Well, I think they get away with it because they pay for science for sale. I mean, there are studies, certainly.
Science for sale.
Virtually any side of any issue. I mean, weren't we told by the tobacco industry that, tobacco couldn't cause cancer and smoking was not a harm? You know, so we go through this as a society. We see science being bought, and we see studies being published that are paid for and supported by the industry that benefits. They have a vested interest, and those studies are out there, certainly. But when you look at the prevalence of the studies, you know, and you look at the weight of the evidence, there's certainly the science on the side of harm is overwhelming on this stuff. And so, you know, again, I think often people have to reach their own conclusions about these things because the regulatory agencies are so politicized and the laws are offer too much deferential or discretion, deferential authority or discretion to the agency to, you know, accept high levels of risk, high risk factors. Do we allow one excess cancer per million population? Is that really an acceptable number? Is it really one, or could it be 10, 12, 20? You know, we find, you know, are we studying the synergistic effects, the mixtures of chemicals, which the National Academy of Sciences has told EPA repeatedly it must look at but doesn't?
No, it looks at chemicals individually, one chemical
right,
at a time.
Right. Well, now we're starting to look, and we have been because of the 1996 Food Quality Protection Act, we do look at chemicals that have a cumulative risk. So chemical families like organophosphates, where EPA has made a determination that they have a common mechanism of toxicity, then we start doing an aggregate risk assessment. So we say, okay, you're getting it through your water, your food, your garden,
right,
et cetera. But we're certainly not doing that. We're only doing that now for three families of chemicals, organophosphates, carbamates, and we're starting to do it with synthetic pyrethroids. We don't do it with phenoxyherbicides like 2,4-D. And so we don't know what the aggregate risk is. And so if somebody like an industry advocate says, you know, we've done a study on 2,4-D in a laboratory based on an individual exposure, well, I mean, that's not a real-world exposure, certainly, and it may be that that exposure that they were studying didn't cause the kind of cancer that they were looking for.
But
there are all kinds of problems with study design.
But that's exactly the kind of data that they submit, right, to the regulatory agencies. I mean,
right, except when you're looking at cumulative risk and common mechanism, where you look at aggregate exposure and start to add up the various exposures in that particular group. So it wouldn't be just 2,4-D, but it would be all phenoxyherbicides that you would be looking at them in combination, and then you get a better sense of what that exposure really meant. But again, I think there's certainly, even in the context of an individual study with, you know, a single endpoint, the scientific literature is just full of studies that link this chemical to cancer and neurological impacts, kidney, liver damage, and so forth. So, you know, you can argue with the European Union, you can argue with other regulatory bodies around the world, as the industry likes to do, and you can, you know, rely on a technology that has significant, I mean, this is probably one of the chemicals of record that is among the most controversial.
Right, and in Canada, they've actually addressed the use of this, you know, head on with their new, not new, relatively new pesticide regulations, and 2,4-D seems to be, you know, right at the top of their list.
No question about that. I mean,
the weed and feed products, isn't that what we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that was a driver, I think, in the passage of laws outlawing the cosmetic use on lawns and throughout provinces in Canada.
Right. So what does this mean for all of us? What does this mean that they're going to be moving from glyphosate, which has its own problems, its own health, you know, and environmental effects, you know, negative health and environmental effects, and moving to 2,4-D being used in the same way these crops. And how is, you know, the everyday person, you know, going to the grocery store going to be differently? I mean, is there more exposure to something more dangerous here?
Well, you know, the fear is that the same scenario will play out with 2,4-D as played out with glyphosate, and that is we'll see a tenfold increase in the use. We'll see the increase in the use, which means we see more chemical in the water supply. We see more in ambient air. We're already finding 2,4-D in indoor air, even though the chemical has no use in indoor because the chemicals move.
Translocation.
Right. They move from the outdoor environment through drift and volatility. They move with air currents, right? And so they get, attach themselves to particles, dust, and fabric, and they are now showing up in the indoor environment. So we'll see more of this. You know, we know already that if agriculture we think is far away from wherever we're living, we need to think again, because we're seeing transcontinental drift of chemicals.
Sure. I mean, we were just talking about fracking earlier, and you know, we think that we're so safe here down in New York City and on Long Island, and because there's no fracking actually taking place here. But you know, we're literally downwind of all of these fracking operations.
Yeah.
That's exactly the same thing. It's going to travel through the air.
That's right. And so,
but also be in the food. What kind of, I mean, have you tracked through Beyond Pesticides, glyphosate residues? Do you know about that in this, in these particular types of?
Well, we know they're there. Because we established tolerances for all these crops, and so we allow these chemicals on our food. I mean, we created a database called Eating with a Conscience just to show people the effect they're having when they choose organic, because often we hear that particular residue's not showing up in our food, and therefore we don't need to buy it organically. And when you look at an onion, for instance, which has a very low residue of any pesticide, mostly because of the skin, so the edible portion of an onion has very little residue, but there's 65 pesticides allowed in onion production. So what does that mean? That means that even though the residue might be de minimis, we have dumped, pounds and millions of pounds of
into our environment
to produce this product.
Right.
And, it's in the Hudson Valley, and it's ending up in the waterways, and that's affecting everybody downstream, certainly.
Sure.
So, there are a range of residues that are acceptable, but according to EPA, that still result in intake and body burden.
Right.
But that's not the end of the story, in other words. I think we need to be asking, well, how can we as consumers make decisions that affect agricultural practices in a way that creates a reduction on reliance or a reduction in use of these chemicals. And that's where organic comes in. And, these same people that are minimizing the risks associated with conventional agriculture and 2,4-D and the hazards associated with them are the same folks that are marginalizing the efficacy of organic production. And in the case of these engineered crops, it's a double whammy because they're creating a system of agriculture that is making it very hard for organic to survive in the long term because of genetic drift. I mean, whether we're talking about seed contamination or we're talking about pollination, contamination from pollination, because these chemicals are absorbed by the plant and translocated through the plant and they end up in the pollen, and so we see genetic drift associated with these bioengineered products, and wind is another way that we causes cross contamination. And so, what is really organic? Even though genetically engineered organisms are explicitly excluded from organic production, it becomes the burden of the organic producer to protect him or herself, and even though they're putting buffers up and all these other things, it is really difficult to protect oneself from genetic drift.
Well, it's impossible. I know that you, in your recent forum that Beyond Pesticides had, you actually focused on bees and the colony collapse disorder. How is this impacting bees?
Well,
you talked about the pollen.
Yeah, glyphosate's a good example of our inability to regulate to protect bees because, you know, it works as a systemic pesticide. I mean, that's the whole way it
gets
down
to
the root system. And so as it goes down to the root system, it goes through the plant, and it ends up in pollen. And it used to be that EPA would say, we can use highly toxic pesticides with a label warning that don't allow plants to be pollinated while plants are in bloom, because, you know, with these contact poisons that they have traditionally sprayed, meaning you spray a pesticide on a plant, it leaves a little coating of the toxic chemical and the
right. So you have
to
put up little signs that say,
right,
bees do not pollinate this field.
Right.
Yeah,
so,
bees.
You know,
in bee speak,
that bees are only attracted to fields when the plants are in bloom and so forth and so on. It had an effect. I mean, if you could keep your bees out of the field during bloom, then you wouldn't lose a third of your hives. Now, of course, these things are integral to the plant, you know, so you can't keep the bees out of the field all the time, you know, and so you end up with a situation where the regulatory system and the restrictions in place do not match the current practices. They don't even take into account biology and, you know, the way in which our ecosystem operates. I mean, they never really did, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't always be trying to kill things in our agricultural systems. We would be trying to
grow
build
things.
Health. As
grow
we
things
do.
using what Mother Nature has given us.
Exactly.
So,
you know,
this
it
is
fascinating on a number of levels. But I think that, you know, colony collapse is really an indicator of a failed regulatory system. And similar to the biotechnology, it, you know, we've gone down this road. I'm hoping this is the last gasp for the chemical-dependent industry, that we as a nation will wake up and really realize that we have to support organic agriculture as mainstream agriculture. We have to protect it as a valuable label, certified organic. We have to engage. It's a very democratic process to determine what are acceptable materials, what practices must be in play through organic systems planning to ensure that we do proper tillage and rotations and fertilization and protecting soil microorganisms and biodiversity, all the things we've been talking about in terms of ecosystem protection, and that we use that system so as to marginalize these approaches to agriculture, which just are not even productive and profitable. I mean, it's hard to believe that we're introducing and unleashing yet a new form of biotechnology here with 2,4-D when the farmers that have utilized these approaches are not very profitable right now, whereas organic farmers are really, you know, showing quite successful profitability in a pretty bad, as we all know, economic climate. And I should say one other thing. One of the arguments we get on organic all the time from the naysayers is that organic can't feed the world. And again, there are studies. Most of what we talk about is study-based. And here again, there are studies that show that organic systems are more effective.
Right.
Not only
they're better at feeding the world and local. That's right. Local food systems, organic local food systems,
right,
really
and
work. And we know for a fact, our daughter and son-in-law have 120 acres of organic, organic farm, and it's very profitable. And those families that are part of their CSA operation are just, they're so fortunate, and it shouldn't be just a few people. Everybody should be operating, you know, in that same kind of a food system.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jay, this has been really, so wonderful. But, it's just one more thing. I sure hope that you're right by saying that this is the last gasp of the chemical industry. I'm like, yes, wouldn't that be great?
It better be, because, organic farming systems really are protective not only of human health and environmental health and the ecosystem, but from a global warming perspective.
Absolutely.
You know, they sequester carbon to a much higher degree. Biotechnology systems are counterintuitive to carbon sequestration. They are highly dependent on synthetic fertilization, And unless we get off that treadmill of synthetic petroleum-based fertilizers and start developing systems that produce nitrogen naturally and feed the soil, as you guys know really well from all your work in turf management, the same system where we give much more attention to soil health and plant health, and you know that creates a system that is life-sustaining in the long term. So we've got to go in that direction, and I appreciate all the work that you guys do to get the word out.
Well, thanks, Jay. Jay Feldman, Executive Director of Beyond Pesticides. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you come back and do it again sometime.
Be happy to.
Thanks, Jay. Okay. You've been listening to Green Street here on WBAI, and I'd like to remind all our listeners that this program and all Green Street programs are archived here at WBAI and also on our program website, which is www.greenstreetradio.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter if you want to know what's coming up on future shows we send out, or it's the afternoon or the day before the show. So you can sign up for our newsletter there. Special thanks, of course, to Jay Feldman, our guest, and our staff here at WBAI, Tony, Kathy, Berthold, Reggie, Jennifer, our engineer Max, all the others here who make us feel like family. We're going to be back in 2 weeks with another edition of Green Street. And until then, be well, be safe. Good night.
Hi, this is Jake Sufnarowski, former talent buyer at Wetlands Preserve. When I'm not driving my gas guzzling SUV, texting my friends in my handheld mobile device, or listening to my local Clear Channel affiliate, I'm definitely tuned to WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York City, 99.5 FM.
On Wednesday, January 4th, 2012, from 9 to 10 p.m., catch up with what's been happening with women's rights in 2011 and get a peek at the future as you kick back with some great feminist music. Joy of Resistance hosts Moretta Short and Fran Locke will speak live with Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, and Jasmine Burnett of Sister Song NYC and Trust Black Women. We'll talk about everything from that morning after pill retreat by the Obama administration to the new bill targeting women of color's reproductive rights that has the nerve to name itself after Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony. So tune in Wednesday, January 4th, 2012, from 9 to 10 p.m. for Joy of Resistance, cutting-edge feminism you can't afford to miss.
On Saturday, January 7th at 2 p.m., the WBAI Community Advisory Board and the new Shakespeare Liberation Front will present the play Time Limit. This will be at the Hudson Park Library at 66 Leroy Street in Lower Manhattan. That's Saturday, January 7th at 2 p.m. with the play Time Limit at Hudson Park Library at 66 Leroy Street in Greenwich Village. It's